What can one walk into a forest and spot as being wicked and wrong and something that they should
clear cut?
Just a clear cut.
Anyone.
All right. So you phone them up and they say, well, it isn't too wide. You know.
Walk it. Pace the bloody thing off.
Mm-hmm.
Younger than a certain age, because if you have trees which are mature and you do clear cutting as they do in some places, is this the same as doing indiscriminate clear cutting?
In Canada, with the exception of experimental stations, of controlled study sections, of areas that have been planted on an even age basis, we have what is known as a mixed wood stand. This is our natural stand in Canada, a mixed wood stand. It ranges from 0 to 150 years of age. It goes up and down, in and out. It's just an uneven age forest. And this is what Mother Nature demands. Mother Nature says, thou shalt not place upon the earth a monoculture. Because this is where your trouble begins.
And by monoculture, you mean just nothing but spruce?
That's right. You put in all balsam fir, and all of a sudden, they're all 50 years of age, and you've got umpteen million acres of them, and the spruce bedroom says, wow. The history of forestry in Nova Scotia is a short, sad tale. Let's see if it ever is written, because we don't keep proper records. I think I referred you to the Broad Arrow. This was one of my desires, to see this Broad Arrow tree, because here would be a viable red spruce. Here would be a viable hemlock with that monometal tag.
Mm-hmm.
And as it progressed through research and study, you would see what fallout came in fertile seed.
Mm-hmm.
You would see what growth rings it put on, because an increment border isn't going to hurt it, you know. And you're going to find out what you're getting.
Mm-hmm.
But you see, as long as you keep chopping the goddamn things down,
mm-hmm.
how in the hell are you going to know what you should have? I would think that in some small areas of relatively inaccessible forest land in the southwest part of Nova Scotia, there are still stands that are reasonably primeval, in the sense that on one occasion we were out with a group of federal foresters and had a fine lunch watching the squirrels play up and down this great hemlock, and I was very pleased to note that all the foresters were using reeloscopes and measuring with quadrants and astrolabes and God knows what all, saying, you know, it's umpteen feet high.
Mm-hmm.
And some stupid fat layman there gave them the height within a foot.
Mm-hmm.
And this got pretty upsetting, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a tree 170 feet high,
mm-hmm.
which is a big tree in Nova Scotia. Now, I don't know what forest giants existed before, because I haven't been able to find. It's very difficult to find history of forestry in Nova Scotia. It's very difficult to find history of forestry in Canada, because this country was founded on the goddamn beaver. You know, everything was beaver, and it didn't very much matter what happened to the trees. You know, we built our first stockades, we built our first cabins, we did everything in the trees. Trees were in the way. Get the bloody things out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, clear. We've got to have land. So we had our own North American dream, perhaps not as sophisticated as below the border, but certainly had our dream of clearing everything and
developing it.
And everyone says, what in the hell happened? Why are the porcupines burgeoning? Why are we being inundated with porcupines? Why is every male mature porcupine devouring in his lifetime $25,000 worth of timber? It's so goddamn simple. In 1927, we trapped out the last bloody fisher, which is the natural enemy of the porcupine. The fisher is a vicious little animal. If you put him in a cage here and he had galvanized wire, he'll bite until his jaws bleed.
Mm-hmm.
Because he must be free,
mm-hmm.
and he must live in the high timber,
mm-hmm.
and he must have a riding hill. He loves to sort of take off when he sees you. He doesn't like man. And he, choong, you know,
mm-hmm.
a reverse ski slope sort of thing, you know. And to give you an example of how fast these little bastards are, we were importing them in from Maine, trying to get some natural control back. We had 27 of them in these mm-hmm. cages. I had one still photographer and one telecine photographer. The 27. I got one still shot, and I got 3 seconds of telecine. The first lot we released, that's how fast they are.
Mm-hmm.
They're just out of the cage and, you know, just unbelievable. But I've never seen them operate on the porcupine.
Mm-hmm.
But what they do, the porcupine shuffles along, you know, that funny noise he makes as he bristles along.
Mm-hmm.
They come up to him, and they have a fantastic fur. Now, you can imagine how valuable it was, because it's almost as if the quills can't get in.
Mm-hmm.
You see, it's so thick. It's such a beautiful fur. And what they do is they simply, very quickly, flip the porcupine over, and they have these very sharp teeth, and they simply disembowel them, you see.
And there are none of those left.
No, but the province has brought some in recent years, but nowhere near enough.
Mm-hmm.
Nowhere near enough. But at the same time, in the ecological sense, I don't see how the fisher could ever make the comeback, because the trees are going so goddamn fast. Where's he going to go? He needs, you know, He needs some high timber. He needs tall timber. When I say that, I'm not necessarily meaning British or West Coast Douglas fir things, but I mean he needs a certain stand. He has to operate very quickly. He sees something that he wants. He's got to whip out and get back, you know, because he's a small animal. He's not that big. I would think a mature fisher wouldn't go more than 10 or 12 pounds. Might be 14 at the maximum. You know. But don't put your fingers in the cage. Because they don't just bite, they nip them right off, you know. There's a very unusual thing about the fisher, which intrigued me because I'm not a biologist, I don't follow all these things, but when the old lady comes to term, here are the little darlings lying there looking for sucker, and she immediately goes out and if she doesn't get laid, they die. She must get laid again, immediately, and then she comes back and nurses them. And I just think it's fabulous.
What the reason is for that?
Hmm?
I wonder what the reason is.
Well, what about this bug that travels in the groups? It travels in the odd numbers. And at a certain particular time, the males travel in that number. Is it five? Yes, it's five. And they travel in numbers, in fives. And at a certain day in the spring when the STP is right or something, two pairs turn on each other. And they, you know, and two pass away. And then those two survivors, and one survives. And this fifth guy always sits there. And this guy's already been through two scraps, so he knocks him off, and he goes to the female. You see the areas that were clear cut. And they come back. And then this is habitat for deer. And because of the clear cutting, or the burning, which, you know, is equally bad, or perhaps repeated burning even, there's a very slow growth, and you go on the range, and you see the odd deer sort of, you know, and you see them getting thinner. In Sweden, if a forester in an area says, I am going to cut blocks A, B, and C, and one is by a river, on a forestry board in Sweden, in a village, there are representatives of the village, there are doctors, lawyers, you name them, wildlife biologists, foresters. And the head of the board may be a doctor, may be a lawyer, maybe just a businessman. He'll say, well, what are the implications if you cut this block by the river? And the biologist will speak up and say, well, if you cut that block out, the deer will not be able to go down to water in a shelter belt. They must have a shelter belt. They insist on having shelter to and from their food because they have fantastic enemies here. You know, the wildcat, they have any number of enemies. So there's a need for this. Getting together around the table and thinking these things out.